You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Today, our guest is Quincy Gideon, a licensed clinical psychologist in Los Angeles who has more than 12 years of clinical experience treating trauma and trauma-related disorders. Her journey to becoming a psychologist began in 2006 when she was an aid worker in a small village in Zambia and was overwhelmed by the amount of trauma she was hearing in the stories of the villagers. She began asking herself, what does a person do with this much trauma? How do they heal? She knew there had to be a way to help address trauma for survivors of war, abuse, and terror. After years of traveling back and forth to different countries in Africa, Dr. Gideon enrolled in a master's program for professional counseling and then relocated to Los Angeles to pursue doctorate and master's degrees in theology. During that time, she trained as a forensic and clinical psychologist. Dr. Gideon opened her private practice called Woven Together Trauma Therapy in 2018. Through this practice, she helps trauma survivors overcome trauma with practical, compassionate, and insightful mental health care. With her extensive forensic experience, she also created Gray Matter Psychological Assessment, which specializes in testing and assessment for such clinical and forensic issues as ADHD, learning disorders, and memory impairment. And for people who can't access those services in California, Dr. Gideon co-created Traumastery, an online platform for therapists and trauma survivors. Welcome, Dr. Gideon. Thank you for coming on our podcast.
Welcome, welcome.
It's my pleasure. Who else needs a nap after all that?
No, that was awesome. We love your background. In fact, okay, so we were just talking before we jumped on. We learned about Dr. Gideon from a colleague at the University of Southern California, Kat Moore, the amazing Kat Moore. And Kat said, you know, because one of the things that we like to talk about is religious trauma. Part of our goal is to sort of bring guests on our podcast that can help people, you know, learn to heal from religious trauma. So anyway, when she said, oh my gosh, I know somebody you need to talk to, we were like all over that. So your background in trauma is, yeah, that's big. But before we get there,
okay,
we always ask a standard question at the beginning of our episodes.
We do. And that question is, what is your religious and spiritual journey from your first memory of it to the present?
Well, I grew up in a fundamentalist Southern Baptist church, which was kind of the marrying between evangelical fervor for bringing people in, but a deep theology in fundamentalism. So lots of gender roles, lots of repression of women, lots of rules around hair and dress and dancing and sexual experiences and who you could date and what age that was appropriate. And so there was a lot of intensity in growing up. I was a coach's kid in Texas, and we moved a lot. And one of the very practical things that I think my parents thought that they could do for me was get myself and my brother involved in a church rather quickly. We would move to towns and not have new friends for the school year. And so they would almost always start with a church the first week we were in town in order to build up some friendships. And I don't fault them for that. But the messages that I was learning in those churches were incredibly damaging. And I was internalizing them. I was a good old-fashioned perfectionist. I was an anxious kid. I wanted desperately to do the right thing. My family had lots of conversations around morality and being a good person versus being the sinful person that you were sort of born into. And so it felt like there was an intense pressure to not only be a good person, make the right decisions every single time, never mess up, but also change the world. Those things were kind of married in the dinner conversation, certainly. And, you know, that played out for my mom. She was a teacher and she was intent on helping, you know, high school kids become really great at math. My dad was a high school football coach and was parenting a whole bunch of kids that didn't have a lot growing up. And so this was just sort of like this was the thing that we talked about all of the time growing up. That definitely impacted me when I started doing aid work in college. It was all under the banner of some form of Christianity. It was all for the hopes of converting or changing people's lives. And I really started to have some crises of faith when I was going to these communities that really had like a 1950s version of Christianity, because that's when the missionaries had gotten to those villages. But, you know, in the Christian church, we talk about discipleship. That didn't happen. And so there were these really stagnant, harmful views that were all under the banner of Christianity or God. This is what God wants for you. And this was playing out in horribly traumatized, you know, communities. So you've got rigid religion and faith and a high expectation for doing things right, even in like Old Testament biblical interpretations of what the right thing was. And I'm using scare quotes there. And then you had intense war and traumatizing dynamics that were going on. And that was kind of the overlapping pieces that were going on in these African villages. And my little 18 the first time I went, my little 18-year-old brain was like, hugging and praying this away is not working. And that was probably when things started to fracture. And this happens a lot in religious trauma. But when you grow up believing that one misstep can make you lose all favor, you can lose your family, you can lose anything, certainly God's favor in your life, I really felt like the response to my questions that were coming up was more intensity, like leaning further into the faith. I don't understand this. Lean not on your own understanding, but on that of God's. And so even though I was having these internal questions, what that does, and it does this for a lot of people, is it pushes you further into the fundamentalism. It pushes you further into the rigidity, because that's all you've learned growing up about how to cope with these questions that are coming up. So that, I can stop there. There's a lot more to the story, but that was probably when it started, my crises, my change, my questions.
Okay. And then would you say that you're, because that is at the very heart of what I would love to know. So when your crisis of faith started and you were thinking about these individuals that you're trying to help and you can't, as you say, hug it and pray it away, did your own transformation happen at the same time you were trying to figure out how to help these other folks? Like in helping them, did you help yourself? Was it sort of a co thing happening?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I was burnt out and struggling and anxious all the time and traveling back and forth. I think that what probably happened when I went to Africa the first time was the rest of the world is not like my small town Texas upbringing. This is abject poverty. This is, you know, whatever I thought of the world at that time, no matter, you know, whether I thought that was a hard or a good thing or, you know, whatever, I was challenged with that deeply as soon as I landed in Africa. And so then I think I kind of pushed my way into, there's got to be more training out there. There's got to be something that can help me do this. But it was certainly under the umbrella of evangelicalism and proselytizing. I wanted to change people for God, but I thought, well, you know, the praying thing isn't working. So let's like try some science, like, I don't know, the science of trauma care, like something. And so that's when I started my master's program at the very same time that I was in my master's program and applying for doctoral programs, I met my now ex-husband. He was a, what do they call it? Music pastor, a worship leader.
A worship
Lord
leader,
help me.
You can tell you've been away for a minute when you forget worship minister.
Or you can tell that I study way too many cults because the names of all of them are a little bit different. And so you have to you have to grab. Word recall is not my friend this morning. Anyway, he was a worship leader and a semi kind of famous Christian singer in the small little community of Nashville, Tennessee. And as soon as we started dating, it was like, you know, there was a one track of the relationship, and that was to marriage. And so there was lots of rules. There was lots of, you know, quote, accountability partners, and we got shoved into all kinds of Bible studies. But, you know, the underlying current was that I was not allowed to spend very much time with him. That would have broken the rules, certainly of the purity culture that we were in. And so, you know, as we were moving through that, I was essentially marrying a stranger, and all of the anxiety that comes up from that was starting to mount, right? Like, how do you talk about money when you don't even know how much he has in his account, or like what, like how much money do you make? And he wasn't asking me those questions. It was just such a juvenile, I mean, I think I probably reverted back to my like 16-year-old self of like, nothing else matters except the coffee I'm going to get this afternoon. And, you know, nothing else matters except running this nonprofit that I was running. It was such a disjointed and dissociative time. And then we got married and a week later moved to California for my doctoral program, moved to LA. And I don't think that we got past the first week of marriage before really deeply both of us understanding this was a terrible idea. Just fundamentally did not want the same things as each other. I mean, we did in sort of this overarching Christian understanding of what you're supposed to want in a marriage, but like how we spent our time, who we wanted to be in relationship with, how friendships worked, how travel worked, how everything was just disjointed. It was a terrible fit. There was more trauma certainly that went on in that relationship. I was on the receiving end of that. He was a bit of a bear backed in a corner once he realized that he was losing all of his independence and he was used to traveling and all of that good stuff. But at the same time that my marriage is crumbling, I'm also in a seminary that has a school of psychology where I was getting my doctorate, but we're also forced to get a master's in theology at the same time. So I'm taking all of these classes about what is emotional health. Well, I don't know, never embodied it.
Did you recognize that you didn't embody it? I mean, like, were you self-aware enough to realize that?
Not in an articulate way, but in a like shameful way. Right. Yeah, like when you're in lectures and you're like, oh,
falling short there.
Okay. And then you go to your theology classes and it's totally breaking down everything that your uneducated pastors have taught you for decades. I mean, it's challenging everything. And so that's probably when my proper deconstruction process happened, that pulling apart of all of the different pieces and being like, well, that theology was literal trash. Like, it doesn't match up with anything. But I was taught that that was the way, the truth, and the life, right? And so, and then now I also have to look at my relationships. You know, I got into this marriage and followed all of the rules. I should have had a happily ever after. But what I got was trauma and brokenheartedness and isolation and rejection and abandonment. I mean, it was sort of a slow disintegration of everything that I had worked so hard for. And yeah, humbling. That'll bring you to your knees.
So I'm not sure that I was aware that you had experienced all of this and great trauma as you describe it. So what is your definition then of trauma?
I have a couple of different kinds of trauma that were going on in my life. I was I had a lot of vicarious trauma. I was living in Africa on and off for 10 years. I was witnessing brutality and sexual assault and just deep, deep trauma. It wasn't necessarily happening to me, but certainly in the communities that I was living in and I was a part of, you know, any sort of healing initiative, it was a lot. It was a lot. I also had a lot of deep personal trauma going on, both in my marriage and also in family stuff that was going on at the time. And then I was coming to understand the religious trauma that I had been through. And as a trauma therapist, I try to make the definition of trauma really simple. Trauma, in my opinion, is something that happens too much, too fast, or too often. So it just comes at you in a way that your brain is not able to fully process. And so part of your brain goes offline and the survival parts step in to just get you through. Now, what becomes problematic in religious trauma, complex trauma, relational trauma, any of those, is that as soon as you get through that and you survive it, something else is coming at you. And then something else is coming at you and something else. And just like being in any sort of abusive relationship, sooner or later you internalize what has been going on. And now you don't even need an abuser because you can do it all by yourself, right? So the brain never actually gets to come fully online and make good decisions. Like now, it's a privilege for me to look back and be like, we weren't talking about finances. We had no ability to negotiate anything in my marriage, nothing. We were such children, but that is a thoughtful, you know, reinterpretation of what was happening. I had no idea what was going on other than I was in a fight, flight, freeze, or fawn space most of the day, including when I was trying to sleep. Right. So it was intense. And trauma is like that, specifically relational trauma. It's not just the one time car wreck that you're in that makes you nervous about being in the car. It's that every time you get in a car, you walk on the street, you do anything, it's overwhelming. That's relational trauma. So it's not just one specific person. It's that all of the people in your life start to emulate these things because those are the people that you've picked. Those are the people you grew up with. That's how you're, you know, reimagining your life and you're just repeating, you know, bad habits that have been going on for a long time because you don't know how to look for anything else.
Yeah. And all those little, I'm going to call them little T traumas, add up to big T trauma.
Yeah. Science is really clear about that.
Yeah. 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 And then especially when you have overlapping ones happening. Yeah. I know one of the things that I really appreciated about learning more about what you do is that you're clear that it's a process. Like trying to heal is a process because of all of that. You know, it's like if you see a bundled, you know, crazy mess of yarn that's all tangled up and you've got to, you know, kind of untangle that a little bit at a time. And so, yeah. Can we go back just a little bit though? Tell me some, and you have some of this on your website, but there, I would just love for you to speak to it. And for our listeners, we're going to include all of her links in the show notes. But what are some, because I really do sort of want to get to the religious trauma piece. I don't know if you would agree that that's sort of foundational, like that, because we're kind of raised in it, it becomes real foundational to the rest of the things that happen. But what are some common examples of religious trauma, other than kind of going into a relationship and not even knowing the basics? What would you say?
So I think that I'm going to trigger warning here. I'm going to talk about some pretty terrible things that happen in churches. So in my opinion, there's a spectrum. On one end of this terrible spectrum, none of the things are good, but on one end, there are the more easily identifiable things that go on inside churches, which is behind closed doors, which is sexual assault, pedophilia, those sort of things that have the grooming that goes on for early marriages and early relationships that totally strip people of the ability to have, like, it changes the rest of their life, right? So that's on one end. That's the sort of things that happen. Somewhere towards the middle, there is the things like purity culture, which are deeply rooted in shame. So those are going to be the things that you are a bad person as soon as you wake up in the morning. And it is the only purpose is to get through this life, die, and then not have to deal with that innate badness in heaven, right? So you're just trying, you're white knuckling it. and the ways in which that increases shame and guilt and self-hatred. I mean, all kinds of things kind of come from that space of learning that we are bad before we are good. In any sort of circumstance.
Well, we're born in original sin. So we just cut right off the bat.
Right. We get right to it, which is so heartbreaking, right? When you hear Christian parents, and this happens too in other denominations like Mormonism and things like that. But you talk about an 18-month-old and like their sinful self and their need for discipline. And I'm like, oh God, what? Like what this theology goes really deep. And I've watched this go on and never questioned it, right? Until I was in, a training program that was like, we should question that. I mean, we should question that. Then I think on the other end of the spectrum are the things that, in my opinion, are a little bit more insidious because they're harder to identify. So this is going to be terrible emotional development. You don't go through the normal stages when you're in a rigid religious environment. You aren't allowed to feel some feelings. Those are, definitions of sin or, ungodliness or whatever. You certainly are not allowed to work through those. And in fact, my biggest problem right now with some of the evangelical or the Christian denominations is how they're not allowed to have feelings in sort of every day, but they're taking out those feelings in our political sphere. So you do have feelings, right? Like, spoiler alert, you can't get rid of them, but you're just not allowed to have them where you're supposed to. And so now you're trying to take away power, control, all of those things from a greater society so that you're not confronted with the hard, grace-based, nuanced parts of life, right? So then there's terrible relational development, just terrible skills in knowing how to relate to people. This is like the mainstay of my story in my marriage. I had no idea. You follow the rules and then you get in a marriage and it's like, well, none of the rules fit here. And how am I supposed to do this? And things like self-advocacy or leaning into some of that shame to understand where it comes from and dismantling some of it, getting to be angry, getting to feel like your body is your own and you get to make decisions around that. There's also a lot of trauma on that end of the spectrum that is a little bit harder for people to identify because it's so intrinsic to the belief system. So things like denial of medical care, that women aren't allowed to have babies in hospitals, that they aren't allowed to practice. Yeah, they're not allowed to use birth control. They're not allowed to get a vaccine. Those sort of things that become traumatic because they either have terrible outcomes or a person is just not allowed to make a decision about what works for them based on their medical care. The Jehovah's Witnesses are a really great example of this. My partner grew up Jehovah's Witness, so I feel like I can speak to sort of the intricacies of it. But if something happened to him growing up, he was not allowed to get a blood transfusion. That's trauma.
Right.
That's trauma that you as a young kid are having to face death and know that no one around you that says that they love you is going to come help you and agree to a blood transfusion if you needed it, right? Like that.
Right.
But there's also things like he was, no one helped him go to college. That fundamentally changed his life and put a burden on him that he was having to do. He would get taken out of his, 7-year-old birthday party when someone brought cake in the classroom, he would have to go sit in the library because he wasn't able to celebrate. So these sort of things add up to a person, right?
Yeah.
And they become something that they have to contend with. And, trauma is when something is introduced, it overwhelms you and you have to contend with it, but you didn't pick the trauma. You did not choose that drama. It came at you without your consent, but you have to live with the consequences.
Right. And that's the hard part. Oh my gosh, Dr. Gideon, so much of what you're talking about is my own experience, raised Southern Baptist in Oklahoma. So everything you're talking about just resonates so deeply. And so part of the challenge is I think that people come to some realization that where they are is untenable. And they're suffering, but they don't know what to do because it feels so sinful to even have that feeling. Like we've been taught to even have that feeling means that you're not doing something right. How outside of, like you just happen to learn about this through your educational studies, which is great. Actually, I did too. That sort of was part of my own deconstruction and reconstruction. But what do people do? Like, one of the things, this is a too long of a setup, but I loved the quizzes on your website. Like, you know, how do you know? Like, do you think that you might have been, you know, religiously abused or, you know, and that's a super helpful tool. But how do people, like, I wouldn't have known to go there. So if you're just a regular kind of person who's suffering with some of this trauma, and you feel like it's a sin to even be exploring that trauma, do you have advice? Like, what advice? I know you have advice. Where can you advise people to start?
I think that that is such a interesting question, because I don't know if I've known anyone to kind of start at the same place.
Right. Yes.
However, I will say that depending on how restrictive your religion is, if you can expose yourself to other things, that's usually a really great place to start. So whether that's allowing yourself to read a book, and start with novels if you need to, you know, like, and you don't have to jump right into like an academic study. But if there's some things that are complete, like, for instance, in the church that I grew up in, there was like a book club of women that just traded like Christian novels back and forth. And there was nothing else on the table. They could not read anything else because there might be a steamy sex scene, to be honest. I mean, that was like a deeply upsetting possibility. So like, maybe you just go to the bookstore and you get a novel that like isn't overtly Christian, right? It doesn't have some like Bible verse written on the front of it. Like, do that if that's where you need to start. Some people are ready for a little bit more. They're a little bit more academically minded. Perhaps their defense mechanism against trauma has been intellectualization. Like, they need to rationalize their way out of it. If that's where you are, go get you a trauma book. I have several that I can recommend. I'll give you guys some recommendations, but a really great one to start with is From Surviving to Thriving by Pete Walker.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very practical way of walking you through how the four trauma responses play out when there's been, you know, childhood abuse, including religious trauma. It fits really well into these categories.
Yeah.
So just expose yourself to it. And when you're reading these books and you're like, oh, that's what's happening when I don't remember my drive home, that's a freeze response. Oh, that's what's happening when I'm rushing and I'm so mad at everyone because they're not at my pace, that's a flight response. Oh, that's what's happening when I can't have boundaries, that's a fawn response. Like, there, it's just a really helpful way to kind of see yourself in what's playing out and be like, okay, so now I have to contend with the fact that there's some practical ways in which this is playing out, and that's a trauma response. And I earned that within a church that said that they were a safe place and that there's no way that I could lose God's favor. Those mm-hmm. two things are mismatched, right?
For sure, yes.
Those don't mm-hmm. match each other. They don't fit each other. And so now just sit with that. Just try to figure out how you feel about that. And okay, so for a lot of people in religious trauma, they can't sit with their feelings. So that might be a really great place to start too. If you're really emotionally shut down and repressed, set a timer on your phone for 2 minutes and just try to feel a feeling, any of them. You come up blank every time, it's time to go see a therapist. If you are totally repressed and you can't access it at all, fine. It, like, you need some help with someone to sort of walk you through that. If it becomes so overwhelming, you start to panic, probably another good indication it's time for therapy. And there's people out there that specialize in deconstruction, myself included, right? I'm not
Yes.
interested in pulling anyone away from their faith system. I'm really interested in saying, let's talk about how that's a trauma response and not God mad at you, and how see how that changes your spiritual experience.
So you just described this for people who may not be able to get through that 2 minute a day practice, right? So what about the ones who can? What's the next step?
Go deeper.
Go deeper.
See if you can.
And how do you go deeper?
Oh, yes.
I think that is, I usually try to connect the emotional state with the somatic experience, which is just your bodily experience. So try to go for longer periods of time, see what comes up. set aside, be very diligent about setting aside some emotional processing time after every worship service that you go to, after every pastor's, you know, whatever that you go to. Sit in your car. If you have kids, leave them in the, you know, in the daycare for 5 extra minutes. Go sit in a quiet space and ask your body, what are you feeling? What's coming up for you? What is that about? Why is that? Are you angry because you were just told that you have to serve your husband sexually? That that's your role in life? Like, be mad about that. See why you're angry about that. If you're not angry about that at all, but you saw some of your the other women stomp out because they were angry about it, where are your feelings? Or do you have a different feeling? What's that about? Why is that coming up for you? So just sort of sitting with yourself and knowing some of those things. I'll just sort of mention that this is a scary territory.
It's just thinking that.
Yeah, it is. It's scary.
Because you think you're doing something wrong.
Yes.
And there are like, and until you get through some, you know, to a place of peace about it, you think that what's waiting, or at least I thought what was waiting was, you know, handbasket to hell, you know, like, I'm just like, so that. The ultimate impact is really life and death.
Yeah, it is. And that's how religions are going to work. If they sit in front of a congregation and they say, it really doesn't matter if you pray this prayer, because that is incongruent with the other message that says you are already loved and adored and saved, and there's nothing you can do to lose God's favor. So let's not worry about the prayer. Let's just worry about how you experience God. That is not consistent with the business of the church,
exactly.
Which is more people coming in, more tithes coming in, paying those bills, having more influence over local politics and
national
politics. So this, in some ways, there's got to be a constant questioning of how is this church doing business and how do they benefit from scaring me every week? Because if I believe I can easily lose God's favor and I'm going to hell in a handbasket, and they've dragged God into every human, normal human question or anxiety, and they've given it some godly meaning, most of which is negative, then I start to question why are you doing that when that is actually not lined up with your faith? What's happening there? And are we messing now with the business of the church? And I'm ready to burn all of that down, to be honest.
Oh, no. Right? I mean, yes, exactly. That's exactly how I felt whenever I first kind of made my way out. And then I decided it's so big that I would just start with individuals instead of the big, you know, like burn it all down. But can we talk about something, trauma and how it lives in the body? Can you speak to that? Because I think people underestimate the impact of consistent, ever-present trauma and fear in the way that we feel.
Yeah.
How does that show up?
So the groundbreaking book that came out that kind of changed trauma therapy was called The Body Keeps the Score by Basil van der Kolk. And he essentially showed about 30 years of psychological and neurological and physical research that showed that once something happens, even if your brain goes offline for a second to help you survive, that your body is keeping the score. So something, whatever sensations were going on in your body that were trying to keep you alive, that were trying to help you survive, your body made note of that. And so then you're going to go out in the world and two things happen. Number one, you will experience something and your body will be like, oh yeah, that's when we need to act like this. That's when our stomach needs to cramp. That's when we need to get all sweaty. That's when we need to, our mouth needs to go dry, right? Because there's something that's sort of going on. Or maybe we just need to buzz with anxiety because we need the extra energy to run, right? So it has now an outside trigger that you have not made the connection with. Now that has triggered a physical response that now you learn to hate your body for because it feels like it's betraying you. Because you haven't made that connection, right? Mm-hmm. And that's
Double
really what
whammy.
Therapy is doing, is we're trying to figure out what those connections are so that when that happens in your body, it's not your fault. It's a look around you and be like, oh yeah, it's the smell of that cologne that triggers me every time because that's what my assailant wore. Or it's the sound of, I have I have a friend, she talks about this often, but showers were very hard for her after she had a really traumatic wreck, a car accident, and she was 8 months pregnant and lost the baby because the crunching of the glass sounded like her shower. So she took baths for a year because she just could not, but she did not understand that that was a connection until about 6 months in, because what does water have to do with this wreck? And right, why is it so scary and terrifying? And why am I like seizing up with anxiety because of it? Okay, so that's the first thing that happens, is that there's a trigger and there's a bodily response and you haven't made those connections. The second thing that's important to point out is that your body cannot, your brain cannot distinguish between whether a trauma is happening in this moment or whether you are remembering the trauma with such intensity that, but it's in the past and it's not happening. So when those trauma memories come up and they have not made all of the loops, so something goes into your prefrontal cortex, it makes its way through other processes in your brain, including your limbic system, which causes those big responses. It's eventually going to make its way to your hippocampus. That's where all of your memories are. That's where your long-term memories are, and they've typically been consolidated. So there's an impression of what happened instead of stark, upsetting details like you're experiencing it in the current moment. So if a trauma happens, if it goes unprocessed, it doesn't make its way through all of your different brain systems, when it's called up in that prefrontal cortex, it's going to feel like it's happening in this moment. And you cannot distinguish between whether it's happening in this moment or whether it's not. Your body cannot.
And then we also have, because you're saying that, but I'm thinking of when I talk with people who no longer believe in hell. Yet sometimes they will see things or receive things in the mail, whatever, that causes their body to viscerally respond as if they do. And they're like, no, I don't believe that anymore, but my body is responding like it used to, which is in fear. So that would be another kind of element of that.
Yep, it would be. And that can happen for a lot of different in a lot of different ways. So just think of the terrifying images. I won't traumatize anyone here today, but the things that I was exposed to that were supposed to scare the ever loving crap out of me and keep me from sinning are terrifying. And those, I will still have flashes of those. I've worked through it enough that it doesn't feel like it's happening now, but I do have a deep sadness for myself when that does come up, because I'm like, oh my God, what 6-year-old needed to see that?
Right.
What 10-year-old needed to be, you know, confronted with that? So the images can be very strong. That might be a part of it. The fear, that flood of fear, you know, when your body goes cold. That flood of fear that happened the first time that you learned about hell and you realized you were headed for it, you know, no matter what you did, that can come up and visit people. Sometimes it's just going to be the nagging, we call them emotional flashbacks, which are when you have an understanding that it's not happening in the current moment. It's not a cognitive flashback, which is what I just described, where you can't differentiate. But it's an emotional flashback where you can differentiate, but you just can't get yourself out of it.
Yeah.
You just feel so terrible. And that can be in a lot of different ways. Like you can feel crushing anxiety and like a weight has been, a weighted blanket is on you. You have a hard time moving. You're lethargic. You're depressed. You're irritated. And you just can't quite figure out what's going on. You know that nothing terrible happened to you the moment that this started. You also know that your body has been reminded of something and you just don't know what it is, and it's hard to shake. And emotional flashbacks can happen for 15 minutes. They can last for weeks. So it's a really insidious part of how your body is trying to help you survive.
Does religious trauma happen more than people expect?
Yes.
I mean, is it a bigger problem than people expect? Because
yes.
I think people greatly underestimate the impact of religious trauma.
Yeah, I think that my own fury, I'm in like a TikTok war right now. So
yes.
Because I have been calling out Matt Chandler.
Yes.
And everything that's going on the Southern Baptist Convention. And I'm pointing out what is going on. First of all, that was a false confession. What a piece of trash
yes.
of a confession.
Yes.
That it, and the way in which there is likely much more to the story that's going to come out. But the way in which Christians are the meanest people on the internet, you should see the comment section on this one video.
Dr. Gideon, will you just describe that for people? Like I know what you're talking about because I grew up SBC and I'm still kind of following it. But for people who may not understand what's happening there, will you just give them a little blurb?
Sure. So Matt Chandler is kind of the golden boy of the Southern Baptist Convention. He has a mega church in the Dallas, Texas area. He has a long history of really sort of making big statements that are kind of calls to action for those that are in the Southern Baptist Convention to essentially sort of bear down on their very conservative, we're all going to hell in a handbasket. We are the ones that have to change this. He has admonished people for their sexual indiscretions. From the pulpit, he has talked terrible, terrible shit around deconstruction. I mean, he has really shamed an entire generation of people as if he has, you know, sort of contact with God in a way that no one else does. A couple of weeks ago, it came out that he was stepping down from all leadership and preaching because he had a, quote, inappropriate online relationship with a woman. He denies that it's sexual. He denies that, you know, anything untoward. In fact, in his confession, he said to the congregation, I personally don't see anything wrong with it, but, you know, the elders do. And so I'm just going to, you know, step down. False confession.
There's
nothing about that that's actually owning that he has participated. The woman that was also involved has not gotten to tell her side of the story. And maybe she doesn't want to, but she should be invited to do so. And they have hired a private attorney or law firm to come in and do a investigation of this inappropriate relationship. And on my TikTok, what everyone is so mad about is that I say, sexual misconduct. Why would anyone else need to step down if you just had a friendship? So either one of two things happen. You had a very inappropriate relationship and you've hired a law firm that came in that specializes, and I quote this from their actual website, discreet internal investigations. That's what they do. And they're privately hired, right? This is not the DOJ. and what they're investigating also with the Southern Baptist Convention. But so either there's terrible misconduct that's gone on and no one's admitting it until something comes out that they can't deny, right? Or we're doing the same old purity culture thing where men and women cannot have friendships without it literally imploding an entire church.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Neither of those are good options.
No.
Right?
Right.
So I have been talking about this, and I'm talking about how this perpetuates religious trauma, because now it feels like we're having to, you know, support our entire faith and defend a man that we know nothing about, except that things don't look very good.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And I am telling you, the meanest people on the internet are Christians. The way the venom, yes, mm-hmm, the venom that they're coming at me with, and I'm going, why are you so defensive?
Yeah,
right. Because I said sexual misconduct. Is that why you're so? Yes, it is.
No, it is, and that was one of the. That makes me think of a couple of things in talking with people who have left the church, whatever you know that means for a lot of the people that I spoke with. For my doctoral research, it's mainly evangelical, but hypocrisy came up over and over and over. And so to have leaders who preach one thing and then they're discovered to be doing exactly the thing that they're railing against, you know, it just, you know, that just devastates people. That is devastating. And then to be gaslit about it on top of that is traumatizing. But then the other thing I was thinking about, I was having flashbacks to when indiscretions happened in the churches that I was raised in. Invariably, it went something like this. The indiscretion would come to light. The man would get up in front of the congregation and do a tearful confession and then be forgiven and accepted back in. And the woman was nowhere to be found.
Yep.
Ejected from the community, and how unfair I always thought that was. Of course, I didn't have, as we've talked about a little bit, I don't have the language for it, but I just remember thinking at the time, I don't understand how that's right. So yeah, that's a problem. And I was hoping that you would talk about, when I heard that you were Southern Baptist, the SBC stuff, because there's a huge There's a big national conversation happening around sexual misconduct.
Yes, DOJ. Yeah, the DOJ has launched an investigation because there was a internal investigation that went on where over 20 years of abuse had been systematically covered up by the individual churches and the SBC at large. And these are, yes. This is not just, the ways in which we're all taught we're going to hell in a handbasket. It's not that sort of trauma. These are horrible situations with 13, 14, 15-year-old girls that are groomed and brought into sexual relationships with pastors.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It comes to light. It's not reported to the police because this SBC does not believe in that. This is a horrible sort of internal thing that goes on. They wag their finger at whomever the adult was that is perpetuating this violence. They gaslight the victim, and that victim ends up having a lifetime of mental health issues.
Yes, yes.
In order to keep someone in power that is a dirtbag. Like, what are we doing?
And it's powerful. That system is so powerful. And I've been saying for years, when I talk about, especially sexual misconduct within the church, people are like, oh, that's the exception. Right. And I'm like, but it happens way more than people want to talk about. I just think it's a problem, like a big kind of foundational problem. Oh, here's Deborah.
I was just going to say, you two have so much in common.
I know, it's okay.
I just kind of sit back and listen, which is kind of lovely. But I wanted to tell you how great it is that you are taking this stance publicly on TikTok, and you seem absolutely fearless about doing that, which is marvelous.
Yeah.
What can people who are watching this battle between you two or among this community on TikTok, what can they learn about healing from this sort of religious abuse?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think, healing from religious trauma and abuse it's a slow process, and you do need someone that knows what they're talking about. I walk people through that. I have a monthly thing where I invite people to come in. I'm like, let me teach you. Let me help you manage your overwhelm. And then also we have a group call that everyone can get on once a month, and we can just talk like, what's going on? What do you need? I know someone in that town. If you need individual, resources, this is a process that it's going to have to be sort of slowly unwound. But if you find yourself in the social media space and you find yourself deeply upset, not that these things have happened, but that people are talking about it and they have an attitude about it, like I do. I have an attitude. I'm pissed.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to come at it because I'm angry.
Right.
And by the way, I was told that I couldn't be angry my entire life. And so I am trying to teach specifically women, you can be angry and you are going to get this sort of treatment. But look, I woke up yesterday. I didn't die. Right? Like, it didn't totally plow me over. It upsets me because some of the venom is just sort of like, oh God, we need to talk about your faith, sweetie. Like, that is there. We have lost the plot, but I just sort of watch what happens, watch that people survive it, watch that they can speak out, watch where the anger is pointed. If it's pointed towards the abuse, listen to them. If it's pointed towards the person that's pointing out the abuse, go somewhere else. And I think we really have to be discerning about that because discerning. How about that for religious language?
I know. I totally mm-hmm. got there. Mm-hmm.
I think that, at the beginning of my own journey, and I see this a lot in my patients, that there is this, there's something so normal. There's something soothing about it being normal to watch venom being flung at people that are calling this out because we grew up in that. And so I sort of noticed that, but it felt good. It felt good to sort of hear them say back to me what had always been said to me, right?
Yeah,
there was
right.
something very regulating about that, but it wasn't the truth and it wasn't helpful, and we have to get beyond that.
Yes.
So is this comforting, this message that's happening, is this comforting because this has been the rallying cry of your church for as long as you've known, or is this comforting because you feel seen? That's a really helpful differentiation.
Yeah. And for many people, it's because it's what they've always known. That's why it feels familiar and comforting. Yeah, it's a process. I know we don't have a whole lot of time, and we have two more questions for sure we want to ask you. But also, I would love it if you would, I don't know how much time we have to do this, but your part of what I love about what your practice offers, there are different modalities, which I assume whichever modality that people are served by, healed by, depends on kind of what they're struggling with and what they respond to. Is that fair? And like one of the ones that I thought was so helpful, well, I know is helpful to many people, it's like EMDR.
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't know if you can just speak to the modality, the difference in modalities.
Yes. I think two things need to be considered when you're picking a therapist. Number one, are they promising you results in a week? Go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Because trauma is a slow unraveling. Secondly, are there different options in that clinic for different treatments? Because there are a lot of, you come to trauma therapy in different spaces. Sometimes you need something like EMDR because it is literally that brain base that I was just talking about, moving things from the prefrontal cortex into the hippocampus, right? We're doing that with bilateral stimulation, usually with your eyes, but it can be done with other things. That is attempting to do something so that you can get to the talk therapy.
Yeah.
And you can talk it out and you can make spaces. If you are highly dissociative, EMDR is not your thing. And I really recommend brain spotting. We have an expert in brain spotting at our practice that is literally for the people that might benefit from something like EMDR, but they're too dissociative. They can't stay present in their own experience long enough.
Yeah.
Brain spotting is wonderful for that. If you are in a space where you have really done a lot of work, you're still chronically depressed, chronically anxious, you're having a hard time kind of turning off some of those bodily systems, I really recommend ketamine. And we have a ketamine-assisted psychotherapy where it's FDA approved. You work with our medical group that's part of our practice. And, you know, the science behind this and like the results, there was one study that just came out recently where someone that had been suffering, or lots of people that had been suffering with chronic depression, had a 96% reduction in their depressive symptoms after one session of ketamine.
Huge.
And listen, that's not, again, that's not that promise that everything is going to be okay.
Yeah.
But when you can do that in the presence of a trauma therapist, and then you move into the talk therapy part, then you're really sort of in that trusting relationship with someone that helped you make that breakthrough. And now we can make use of that and we can kind of move through it. So there's many paths to heaven, right?
Yes.
And treatment modalities is one of those.
Well, and I also want to plug, just before we go to our final couple of questions, your website is tremendously helpful. We will link it because there are quizzes on there that sort of help you get a sense of, you know, are you struggling with these things? But also, I just found the workbook last night. You have a workbook that kind of walks people. I can't remember for how long. Will you just share about the workbook?
Yeah, for religious trauma.
Yes.
Yeah. Essentially, it's a 6-week program. It's really 10 weeks, but you can get it done in 6 weeks if you want to be quick about it. But every week, there's kind of a different overarching lesson. We walk you through whether that's purity culture or deconstruction or magical thinking. And I teach you about those concepts. And then there's like a ton of journal prompts. So
Perfect.
It's meant to be a space that you can really reflect in.
I love that so much. I'm going to be doing that, even though I've done a whole lot of stuff. Keep going. Okay. Deborah is trying so hard to keep us on track. Okay. Go ahead, Deborah. I know you're like, whatever.
These efforts are usually for naught, but it's so fascinating listening to you talk. I don't want you to stop talking either. However, our two final questions, I'll pose the first one.
Okay.
And we really are very short on time. So just a quick, whatever comes
you got
to your
it.
Head.
You got it.
What is your favorite spiritual practice?
Walking in nature, hikes, being outside.
You're not the first person to say that. And it's one of what I consider the most lovely and peaceful practices.
Yeah.
Robin, you have the second question.
I know. And it's I just want to know, who is your spiritual role model?
I have lots of them. It's hard to pick. I think that my religious trauma taught me not to rely on one person.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to not like something about every single spiritual leader, because that means that I'm having some really healthy questions come up.
Yeah.
And I don't like kind of what they're selling me, which is that they have the answer. So I have too many, and I really don't let myself get kind of pigeonholed.
Okay. I love that. Absolutely. And sometimes for me, it's like I grab from you because this is what I need for now.
That's right.
And then I grab from you because for sure.
That's right. Yeah. And it should be that way.
Yeah.
This was so fascinating and so much fun. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. My pleasure.
Really, really appreciated having you on. And for our listeners, we're going to be dumping in so many links to your to your things through in our show notes.
Okay.
So just thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.